Tonight on the Steve and Dan Podcast, Steve and Dan discuss episode 504 of The Walking Dead, Slab Town. Hi, I'm Steve.
And I'm Dan, and we're going to talk about The Walking Dead, Season 5, Episode 4, titled Slab Town. Alternative title, E-R. You like that?
That's bad. Oh, that's bad. Yeah, actually, I subtitled my review, which I'm still in the process of writing, Dawn of the Dead. So there you go. I guess we're both kind of going after the puns today. So, we had three hits, didn't we? Three hits. And now, what do we call this one? Not a hit? Is it a single? Were the other ones home runs and this one's a single or maybe a bunt?
I've got no idea. I don't even know what sport you're talking about.
I think you call it rounders. Rounders, I believe. It's not, I mean, okay, if this was any other series, this would not be a horrible episode. And in fact, I'd rank this like well above average, but it certainly was not excellent.
No, it counts as a bit of downtime, I think.
Andrew Lincoln needed a holiday.
Yeah, it had to happen.
But thank goodness that Emily Kinney as Beth just carried the show with her incredible acting.
Oh, you think so?
I'm just trying to bait you here.
Incredible eye acting.
Well, she and shoulder hunching, too, when she's looking out the window.
Pregnant pauses that are in no way pregnant at all.
Oh, with the trembling lips, too. I thought that was very well done.
Yeah, so there were two pregnant pauses in the show. Neither of them communicated anything to me other than total vacancy.
Well, you know, in her defense, Kinney hadn't been on set for about 8 months, so maybe she'd forgotten how to act in the meantime. I still think she's presenting as this young, somewhat naive, yet Daryl-trained, not debutante, but certainly somebody who's still learning the ropes. She has the doe eyes, so she plays with that a bit, I think. Mm-hmm. But she also has kind of the meaner streak underneath. Interestingly, last night, just a little personal anecdote here, I did watch the episode with my mother and father. They came out to watch the episode with my family, which I must say, guys, you know, if you want to have a good family night, forget the turkey, just have a Walking Dead night. It's fantastic. It brings you together. Nothing quite like cannibals and dead walking to bond over. But my mom heard Beth once and she said, God, she's got the most annoying voice.
I like your mom, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah, she does have a bit of a little girl kind of whiny pitch to her voice, which can certainly grate. And I'm sorry, Miss Kinney, I think you're wonderful. I don't think you're a horrible actress, as does my good friend and bad critic Dan here. But
being harsh. I don't think the acting was particularly bad. I think that a lot was asked of Beth in particular. I just don't think she's... I don't think she's the best dramatic actress, to be honest.
Well, and the show's never been known for its acting, particularly. No. You do have... I mean, Norman Reedus playing Norman Reedus, and he does that very well. You have Carol, who I think has quietly become one of the best actors on the show, frankly. Mm. Andrew Lincoln, who was just horrible for the first two seasons, has finally kind of found his footing, I think.
He's definitely grown into it.
Much better.
The more feral he gets, the more effective he gets.
Carol has fewer lines and is therefore much better for it.
Judith had her first line last week.
She sure did. And the people they're bringing in, I mean, you look at Father Gabriel, he's an excellent actor. He's been around a long time, and he's got chops. So I think they're bringing some good people.
Yeah, and Noah, Noah seems to be pretty good too, just from what I've seen of him. Tyler James Williams, guy who used to be in Everybody Hates Chris.
Yes. And even the additions of, like, Abraham and Eugene last year, they're both really good actors, have been around a long time. I off the top of my head, I can't remember the name of the actor that plays Abraham. Do you have that?
No, not in front of me.
I first saw him in Band of Brothers. He played a sergeant there, and he was fantastic in that show. Did you ever see Band of Brothers?
No, I never watched it.
Okay, well, he had one episode that was his entirely, where he was basically caught behind enemy lines trying to hide in a Dutch farm, and get past the Nazis back to his own people, and it was intense. A lot of silent acting. The guy can really do it. And so when I heard he was cast, I was very, very pleased.
He seems born to play the sergeant.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely built for that. I think he plays sergeants in every role he ever plays.
Actually, just interestingly, the actor who played Noah, Tyler James Williams, was also in House for a while. So this isn't the first time he starred in a hospital drama.
That was the beginning of that season where he had like 8 or 9 interns that all had to compete against each other, right?
Did he make the cut?
No.
Oh, that's why he's here.
That's right. Yeah, he actually got cut from that hospital, so he got a job in this other hospital here doing laundry.
We've now executed our usual disciplined, honed introduction, Steve.
Absolutely.
Maybe
absolutely.
You want to give us one of your great short synopses of what we see tonight.
Well, tonight's a really, really easy show to do a synopsis for because there's really only one storyline. For the first time in this season, we have a focused episode in the sense of following one point of view throughout the whole episode. In fact, I think there's only one scene that doesn't follow Beth's point of view, and that's when we see Noah folding some laundry for Dawn Lerner, when she's on her exercise bike. And there's this obvious kind of power play between the two of them, and there's innuendo that plays there. And Noah just kind of rolls his eyes. But that's the only scene we see where it's not focused on Beth. Mm-hmm. So we follow Beth, and she's in the hospital. She's told that everything costs something. She goes to get food, and there's this really creepy dude named Officer Gorman, who apparently is the guy that brought her in. And we see them interact about four different times, and each time is a little bit creepier, a little bit more in your face. He's a very stock character. He doesn't really have a lot there, not a lot of substance. Mm-hmm. Dawn is working on Beth, trying to convince her that she has to pay a price for the fact that they saved her, so she's got to do her job. She forces her to eat, basically saying that if you don't eat, you get weak. If you get weak, we have to look after you, and if we have to look after you, then you're not worth anything. The doctor takes her under his wing and protects her. There's a whole bunch of these different dynamics happening that Beth's trying to navigate through, because she doesn't really understand who is who's really in charge. And I don't think the people in the hospital know who's really in charge, even though Dawn, in name, is in charge.
The sense that I got was that some band of not-so-good cops that Gorman is part of are really pulling the strings. And he hints later on that Dawn might not be around too much longer.
Now, we do find out that Dawn had gotten rid of her own boss, Hansen, I think was his name, mm-hmm. when Hansen made some bad calls and got people killed.
Yeah.
So this is why Dr. Edwards says that he is loyal to her, because she did what she needed to do to keep them alive. Sort of like what Rick's done in the past and others have done.
Right.
But the compromises that Dawn has chosen are compromises that we haven't seen made by other groups yet. And this is interesting, because every group of survivors we find, they seem to have a different list of compromises that they're willing to make between who they were before and who they are now.
Right.
So Dawn's big compromise is that she allows Gorman and the other creepy cops to basically use sexual favors with the various people they've saved in order to have them pay their price.
There are patients who've just been brought in who are getting patched up. There is the creepy police bureaucracy, and then there's a bunch of long-suffering orderlies who can't wait to get out of there. That seems to be the entire population of this hospital, right?
That does, and it's really important to note, too, that these people that are being saved, we don't really know that they're being saved at all. You have the situation with Beth when Daryl and Beth, back in episode 413 alone, ran from the funeral home. And he told her, I'll meet you on the road, because he's fighting off the walkers. And she says, yeah, I remember fighting a walker, and then everything went black. Well, you know why everything went black? It's because Gorman came out of his car and hit her over the head, mm-hmm. so he could take her. He tells her quite clearly that the walker was eyeing up her thighs, and that he wanted them before the walker got them. he's definitely looking at her as a sexual object. He brought her in as a conquest. He brought her in as somebody he wants to own. He talks about owning her several times.
That was one thing that struck me as weird. They're holed up in this hospital. It seems to be pretty risky to go in and out. Yet, where Beth and Daryl had got to was a long way away from Atlanta. So at first it didn't make any sense to me why the cop would be out that far. But then I went back and there's a line. He says, we got a lead on a couple of guys out there. That's why we were in that area.
Well, they're probably expanding their range. I have no idea why they're bringing so many people in, where they're getting the food to keep them alive. There's not a lot of logical sense to this place.
No, how the generator's still running.
It doesn't seem to work. Well, that seemed to be answered by the use of car batteries, at least in the actual rooms where the patients were.
Right?
At the same time, where are they getting car batteries that have stayed fresh for basically 2 years? The amount of energy that's being used in Dr. Edwards' office, where he has lights and he has music playing, there's a lot of power going through
that. Yeah. One of the good things about this episode, I guess, was that one of the biggest questions that you ask when you're watching zombie movies is, well, why didn't they just do this? The classic example being going to an island. But one of the other examples is, you know, a multi-story building.
That's true. But the issue, of course, there becomes, where do you get your food mm-hmm. from? You know, it's that, and that's something that they're, well, the whole cars with crosses running out on errands and such and picking up people randomly, I'm assuming that they're also going out looking for food. That would be probably their biggest role.
If we hadn't just had a cannibal storyline, do you think we'd be asking those questions?
Oh, guaranteed, yeah. In fact, there was some speculation online that this place was supplying Terminus with meat. I read one interesting speculation that the reason that the two boxcars we saw had an A and a D on them was one was for arrivals, one was for departures. Departures being taken off to the hospital.
No.
Though, no, just exactly. It made no sense to me, but I did see a lot of speculation regarding the possibility of a connection, but obviously not.
It's not a bad theory, but it doesn't really make any sense, which means it's a bad
thing.
Well,
no. And
if we want to speculate for a minute, if Terminus was doing that, if they were part of the supply chain for the new hospital police headquarters in Atlanta, then why would they situate themselves so far away from A, the hospital, and B, the biggest population center? I imagine that you're going to find the most people in and around the city, so why go way out into the woods to do that?
Oh, absolutely. And on top of that, it goes against what Dawn tells us is her purpose, which is simply to sit and wait to be rescued, which is just absurd.
But, well, they really degenerated pretty quick in a year, didn't they?
Again, here's that, you know, but for the grace of God, there go I kind of statement. We don't know how we would react in a zombie apocalypse, although it's fun to speculate on such things. I don't think I'd be feasting on human flesh within 2 years, no. But then again, I don't know how to farm. I do know how to talk to people, and I might be able to convince them to come and talk to me, and then whack them on the back of the head when they've got their back turned, right? So that's certainly a possibility.
Cannibalism doesn't even work mathematically. When you've got a population that's completely decimated, other living humans are going to be a far rarer commodity than all of the tinned food that they've left behind that they can't eat.
Oh, guaranteed, yeah. I'd like to see them have an episode where they go to like a Costco warehouse or something. I think that would be wonderful. They could, in fact, that would be the best building to hole up in. It's huge, yeah. Lots of space, very few entrances, and more food than you would need for 10 lifetimes.
Yeah. So I guess that would be the big reveal at the end of The Walking Dead, was them turning up at Costco only to realize that none of them had a membership card.
Okay, so we've got these people that could have been cannibals, but not quite.
They're a different kind of cannibal. They're preying on the vulnerabilities of the living.
They are, and this comes up actually when Noah tells his story to Beth, because he apparently came with his father. He and his father were living up in Richmond, Virginia, and they came down to look for his uncle in Atlanta. And they both got picked up, but they got injured, something happened. He was told at the time that they could only save one of them. And so the father basically sacrificed his life so that Noah could live. And Noah says to Beth that this is bullshit. Like, he knows now that that's not true, that they could have saved both of them, but that his father was bigger and stronger and potentially more dangerous. And so they chose to save Noah, who was the weaker and apparently less able to defend himself and therefore more easily malleable and would fit into their system. Mm. So this is a huge hint for what comes next. This is the old gun over the mantelpiece right here. It ties back to what we saw at the end of last episode with Daryl bringing somebody out of the bushes, and it also ties forward to what we see at the end of this episode with who's wheeled in.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a little bit, I guess, because really we need to set things up a bit further, such as the friendship that develops between Noah and Beth, right?
So Beth's stuck in the hospital. A particularly rapey police officer is taking a lot of interest in her.
And two men are giving her food. Yeah, Edwards gives her guinea pig, and Noah gives her a green lollipop. So, interesting kind of symbolism there, because, I mean, the guinea pig is obviously, they're showing that they're not eating as well as they used to, that they're having to make sacrifices, but hey, if it's good enough for the Peruvians, as he says, it's good enough for us. Guinea pig is a food product in some countries, and so they know they can eat it, and that's fine. Whereas the candy that that Noah gives to her, we find out later, is from the pediatric ward, and it's kind of representative of his own naivete. On some level, the fact that he is he's almost childlike in his representation.
Yeah, although Dawn keeps a big jar of those lollipops in her office.
There is kind of a hidden symbolism there. I suspect that whilst many of the female patients are being used for sexual favors by the male cops, Noah might be being used the same way by Dawn.
How did handsome young Noah get hold of one of those?
Well, and then that one scene that we see them together, she's busy working out, showing her toughness while Noah's folding clothes. There's this kind of domesticity to that scene.
Yeah.
Of the abusive husband in the background wearing the wife beater undershirt with the harried woman, the abused woman, standing there folding clothes, rolling her eyes, trying not to let her husband see. There's
right,
that role reversal, the gender reversal that's going on, which is a power, it's actually a power issue. She is the person with power. He is the powerless. And you get that strong kind of sense of ickiness going on there. It was not a horror show, but it was creepy, yeah.
Do you remember in Terminator 2? Do you remember where Linda Hamilton, Sarah Connor, is holed up in a hospital at the beginning of that, in a psychiatric ward?
Yeah.
And one of the orderlies is securing her to the bed, and he's on his own with her, and then he just leans over and licks right up her face while she's asleep.
That was
I got exactly gross. The same feeling from Officer Gorman in here.
Yeah, Gorman Gorman would, well, in fact, that one scene when he steals Beth's lollipop, he then forces it into her mouth. It is extremely...
it's kind of ridiculous.
Well, it's extremely sexual. It's ridiculously over-the-top sexual. It's obviously, you know, the lollipop becomes a phallic symbol, and he's forcing himself sexually on her in a metaphysical, not metaphysical, but a symbolic manner. And she's extremely uncomfortable. She actually plays that part in that moment very well. She's kind of trying to keep her mouth closed, but is kind of unwillingly forced to open it. And it's really, really uncomfortable. And you can see...
Yet she's much more receptive to Dr. Edward's guinea pig.
She is. She is.
And why does she turn her nose up at his guinea pig, by the way? Because she's been scoffing Daryl's squirrel for ages.
Well, I think the guinea pigs are, you know, seen as pets. It's very much the same way North Americans will be upset when they hear about other cultures that eat horse. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Japanese eat horse, the Dutch eat horse, the Kazakhs eat horse.
Right. It's, British people think nothing of chowing down on a hedgehog sandwich.
Do you remove the spines first, or is that part of the crunch? Is that...
They soften in brine.
Oh, that's good. That's good. There's a lot of my students. I teach a lot of students from China, for example, who are just appalled by the fact that people eat rabbit. Because rabbits are cute and fluffy and shouldn't be eaten. They're pets. So I think that's Beth's response, is that guinea pigs kind of... You know, it's a pet. But then she does break down, she has a bite, and she's like, yeah, it's not bad.
So we're in the weird multicultural hospital of rape and captivity and the maintenance of the weak.
Well, actually, when you mentioned maintenance of the weak, I just want to bring this back for a second. Do you remember right back in season one when they're in Atlanta and they come across that... that group, that young Hispanic group, of seem like gang members that are actually protecting an old folks home?
Well, that was a long time ago. Yeah, you think that they're bad guys, and then it turns out that they're actually really nice.
You do have this kind of contrast, where you have a group that was protecting the weak there for altruistic reasons. They weren't asking the old people to have sex with them, you know what I mean? It just wasn't, they weren't asking them to clean their laundry either. But here you've got this this bizarro world hospital going on, where the police, who are pledged to serve and protect, have now turned into this group of thugs who are controlling people.
Right.
And it's all about compromises. And Dawn tries to justify her actions by stating that she's doing what's necessary to keep things going, when Beth can just look at several other examples that she's personally experienced and seen and say, no, it's not the only option. You're messed up. You're crazy.
And it seems kind of unusual, because Beth has been the weakest and most helpless character.
And Dawn even points out her... her self-inflicted scars on her wrist.
Yeah, was it a genuine suicide attempt earlier on?
It was, yeah. That was in season two at the farm. She did try to kill herself. That was a misinformed attempt. It was she was giving up on life. But no, going back to where we were, there's a couple of patients that she helps with, because, as we mentioned, Edwards kind of takes her under his wing. And the first one is this fellow that comes in that's fallen off of a one-story building. Obviously, he... didn't watch The Wire, doesn't know how to fall from a third story building. But he falls from one story building, has internal injuries, and Dawn is surprisingly insistent that Edward saves him. Now, mm-hmm. This is the same Dawn that we're told gave the order just to turn off the life support on the first patient we see on Beth's first awake day, that she just makes these calls. And why is she so insistent? We don't know. There's a huge subtext going on here. The doctor's resistant, she's insistent, and Beth tries to walk away. And then there's a really interesting moment between Beth and Dawn, because as the doctor is being, you know, hesitant and saying, look, I need a CAT scan to be able to tell where he's injured, this is not going to work, she hauls off and slaps Beth across the face.
Yeah.
Because that makes so much sense.
Like, she's just the slap proxy.
Yeah. Well, she doesn't want to slap the one and only doctor she's got, does she? But she's also sensing that Edwards has a soft spot for Beth, and so this is typical abuser behavior. Attack.
Well, she's fulfilling the role of the whipping boy. You know the source of the whipping boy?
Yes.
The children of well-to-do families were considered too fair to be whipped themselves. So to punish them, they would get some local riffraff poor child in and whip him in their stead, so as to get the little rich kid to behave just out of pity and empathy for the boy who's going to get whipped in his stead.
This actually has a pretty heavy North American connotation, too, because it was part of the slave trade.
Is that right?
They would actually have an owned slave who was about the same age as the child, and they would whip that slave. Yeah, so there's actually that connotation, which would be more familiar to North American audiences, and is probably the subtext to what's happening there on some level. But I also think it's the whole idea, you know, if you're in domestic violence cases, there's situations where the abuse abuser will threaten those that the abusee loves or cares for in order to get compliance. And I think that's probably what's happening here on some level, is that she sees this soft spot that he's developed for Beth. And so she lashes out and basically is saying to him that if you don't do what I say, Beth's going to pay a price.
And they did the same thing to Noah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And she even knows that she's lied. Yeah, with Noah, that's...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just seems the point is that someone has to pay. Her authority is being challenged, right? So I don't think she could be seen to prevaricate or to let anyone off. So she has to be ruthless. As long as someone gets beaten, it doesn't really matter who gets beaten.
But she's completely oblivious to the total lack of respect around her. Not a single person calls her Officer Lerner in the whole episode. They all refer to her as Dawn. And now if she's supposed to be the person in charge, and she has a title, that title should be used. And she should first and foremost insist on that title being used to establish her dominance of the group. But she's unwilling to because she's afraid. She's a coward.
Yeah, in fact, Gorman even at one point openly talks about deposing her while she's within earshot.
Yeah, we're right in front of her. Yeah, there's no question that he has no respect for her whatsoever.
So she has a very tenuous grip on authority, just as her predecessor did. So it's hinting at the idea that this is not a particularly stable social arrangement and it's on its way out in any case. Could this be something to do with the fact that we have the ticking clock? It's a motif that began in the last episode. We saw lots of imagery of clocks as Bob was going through his demise. But throughout this episode, we see a clock. But then later on, there is the sound of ticking interspersed between the action. I was trying to work out what the clock was supposed to signify. Do you have any theories?
Well, I do agree that it's there for a reason, but I think it could be as simple as time is running out. Now, you say the time's running out for this group. I agree. The first time that I really noticed a clock in any of the episodes was last season in episode 413 Alone, which was the episode where Beth gets taken. When they're in the golf clubhouse, there is a clock that that Daryl goes right up close to, with Tempest Fugit written across, a great big grandfather clock. And it's a focus of the episode, this idea of the time. I think that sort of started this connection between Daryl and Beth and time, so I think that's part of what they were doing last night. But also this connection with last episode, with Bob. Time passing, I don't know. Time is really difficult sometimes to follow in this show. Because you had the break between seasons 3 and 4, which was basically a 6-month break. But the break between seasons 4 and 5 was maybe 2 hours. And so time gets played with a lot as a trope anyhow. Even the taking of Beth. Now, I went to the Walking Dead wiki online, which I'm going to link to in my review on my blog, and it does a timeline for the whole series, right from day one, in fact, pre-day one. And it suggests that the time between Beth getting taken and Daryl showing back up at the church is only 6 days.
Right.
Oh, sorry, 7 days, but 6 days when he follows, and then 7 days when he comes back. So time has been very tight. She's had a little bit of time. She's still got a cut on her cheek. It hasn't healed fully, right? So we know it's been less than a week. But is that anything to do with the clocks in this episode? I don't know.
No. And I was wondering whether it was also just a really sort of clumsy and obvious device, is that we had a lot of clocks in the last episode, and now we have clocks in this episode just to remind us that this stuff is happening at the same time that last episode happened.
It could also be to remind us that we have clocks.
It could be the reminder that clocks still operate.
They exist.
Post-apocalypse.
They are things that we have. Time still passes despite the appearance of no time, because we don't have a television schedule to follow every week.
That's true. On the face of it, that's correct.
On the face of it.
It's good to see you're dialed in to what's going on.
Oh, God. Okay.
If you need a hand with any of these jokes, let me know.
I'm just going to sit here and absorb. I'm absorbing. This is lovely.
So we have this guy wheeled in, and suddenly Dawn wants Dr. Guinea Pig to really try and help save this guy's life.
I realize every time you say Dawn, I hear Gorm. I don't know why this is, so I keep on thinking Gorman whenever you're saying Dawn.
Tell me
you
hear Gorman?
Because whenever you say Dawn, it sounds like Gorm, or something like that to me. It must be your strange pseudo-British accent. I don't know
what
that is.
Yeah, it's my half and half.
Sorry,
accent.
Mate. I'll let you carry on.
Yeah, no, it's all right. Don't worry about it. It's all right, Governor. Yeah, so anyway, right?
Oh, God.
Anyway, this copper, right? Dawn, her name is.
I'll start putting on a nice southern accent for you, too, just to differentiate. I hope I haven't offended anybody with that horrible accent. I'm trying to do my Andrew Lincoln impression here.
Dawn. We could call her Officer Lerner, but no one calls her Officer Lerner. It's not going to work.
She's Dawn. She's Dawn. Absolutely.
She's Dawn. She's Dawn. I can say Dawn, if you like.
You have to do that long A. Dawn. Okay.
Okay. So.
Dawn.
Dawn.
She's wheeling somebody in.
She's wheeling somebody in. And it's this dude, he's all messed up. He's fell off a building. And suddenly she's like, we have to expend every resource this hospital has to save this guy. Completely contradicting anything she said before. She's a real penny pincher. She's like, when Nora and his dad come in, she's like, well, we've only really got enough badly labeled medication to save one of you.
Yes.
So the other guy's just toast, I'm afraid. But she really wants to save this guy. And Edwards seems not particularly to want to save him.
He is an oncologist from another hospital.
Yeah. So you get the feeling that Dr. Edwards probably knew him by sight.
He does. He actually tells Beth that he did know him.
And then Beth later on, as she's rifling through Darn's drawer, she finds, I think, his ID card, right?
And the connection here is that there's a scene where they're on the roof and we see the guinea pig cages and where they're growing some tomatoes and such. I said that for you, by the way, tomatoes. And he asks her to go down and give the patient some medicine. He asks her to give her clozapine, when he should be giving him clonazepam, which is...
Do you know what? I think it didn't matter what he told her to give him, because if you see the way Beth actually prepares that medicine...
That was actually my comment.
Crushes it up.
I was watching it, and I looked at my dad, and I said, there's just no way he's getting any medication out of that syringe that's been... Yeah.
Could have safely ordered saline, and that dude would have been toast.
Yeah, that's probably true. The point is, though, that the doctor set her up. The doctor had her kill the patient. You know, that's not very realistic in the way she was preparing the medication with her little mortar and pestle. And she later finds this ID card and she puts two and two together and she realizes that he wanted the other guy dead because he was a doctor.
Right. And not only, I mean, because he was a doctor, but because his own position is kind of tenuous.
Yeah, he wants to be the only doctor.
Yeah, I mean, so what Edwards is worried about is this. He's not really in the good books of Gorman or Dawn. Neither of them particularly like him. He's already alluded to the fact that he likes to mess with Dawn by keeping his office messy.
He says there are ways we get even with her.
And having Caravaggio paintings lying around. Mm-hmm. And as we know, Dawn is, she can't stand Baroque-style painting. So he's obviously in a tenuous position, so he's worried that if a new doctor comes along, they're just going to dispose of him just like that.
As long as, yeah, unless he toes the line. The thing is, he's an oncologist, the other guy. We never learn what Edward's specialty was, but it appears that he knows something about internal medicine because when the other doctor comes in, he does relieve the pressure in his chest with a
He looks to me to be an ER doctor of some kind.
A trauma specialist, maybe, which is really the kind of doctor you want in this world.
It's exactly the kind of doctor you want.
But he opens up a hole in the guy's chest to allow the pressure out, which reminded me a lot of that scene in Three Kings.
Where
Matt Damon has to keep on relieving the pressure by turning the valve on his chest.
I think that was a punctured lung too, wasn't it?
It was a punctured lung, yeah, exactly.
So I guess that's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Although it was a bit bloodier here. No, that's true. In Three Kings, they actually showed the process of the bullet going through the body and puncturing the lung. Yeah. It's quite well done, actually.
So listeners, if ever anyone appears to be having slight difficulty in breathing...
Get a large tube.
You should insert what looks like the valve for blowing up soccer balls directly into someone's chest without a second's hesitation.
It would be nice if you put a valve topper on it so they could release the pressure at will.
Yeah, so we're not sure what to think about Edwards. Let's talk about this doctor. He's a weird character. Like I said, he obviously seems like a bit of a rebel. He's not as bad as Gorman. He doesn't support Dawn. He's kind to Beth. He tries to make her feel welcome. He shares his guinea pig with her. But was this just so that he could get her on side and use her to do his bidding? Or do we think that he's genuinely a quite conflicted person who's trying to do the right thing here, but he's just scared?
Well, again, we can go back to Beth being cute or an attractive woman. But I think that ultimately his motivation is simply survival. He doesn't really care about how he does it at this point. He's done some bad things. He's been made to do some bad things. He murders this guy with his proxy, with his tool. And then his reasoning, he actually points to the Caravaggio, which is the denial of St. Peter. Mm-hmm. And he points out to that and says, even St. Peter, you know, he denied Christ three times. So what's wrong with me denying my humanity?
Good bit of hubris there.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm like St. Peter. I'm just like St. Peter. I'm going to form a church to me. Just an interesting side point on the denial of St. Peter. The Caravaggio itself is actually, it's held in the Met in New York City. I was kind of assuming when I saw it in the episode that it must be in like some Atlanta Metropolitan Museum, but in fact it is in New York, so just kind of curious as to how it got down to Atlanta and ended up on the street.
Oh, are we supposed to believe it was the original?
It's the original. It's the framing and everything is intended to look like classical framing with gilt and all that.
And he just found it lying on the sidewalk.
He was just lying on the sidewalk.
Maybe now, like Atlanta Art Museum or what have they got down there, just rented it or something.
It reminded me a little bit of... I think it was episode 3 of Z Nation, which is a sci-fi and Space Channel series. Not a very good zombie series, by the way. If you're interested in watching it, don't. But their third or fourth episode.
If you were,
don't bother. You can read my reviews on my website. But their first third or fourth episode, they end up in Philadelphia, and they just happen to find the Liberty Bell sitting on a truck randomly in some street, which they then take the truck, and because of a sudden stop and a broken axle, end up using the Liberty Bell to take out a whole street full of walkers, basically, which is quite badly done, but kind of interesting. Now, if Dr. Edwards had taken that Caravaggio and started, like, slicing off walker heads with it, I think it would have been much more interesting.
Mm.
But he doesn't, because he, too, is a coward, I believe.
Yeah,
In fact, this whole building is full of cowards.
Yeah, it's full of weak people kept weak just to sustain the weak leaders.
Yeah, because...
Who are also quite weak.
There's nothing... But they might be a little bit weaker than we're talking here, because I don't think we're giving them enough credit as weak people. Gorman himself, who comes across as the strongest character, is probably one of the weakest. He's got no personality. He focuses on power as his entire objective and reason for being. And it's all about how he can dominate those around him. He dominates Don. He dominates Dr. Edwards. He has a stare down with him over Beth at one point. And of course, he has the creepy moments with Beth, which culminate when Beth and Noah come up with a plan to get out of the hospital.
Right, yeah. We should talk about these scenes.
That's true. So
what is their plan for getting out of the hospital?
Noah knows that that Don keeps an extra set of keys to the elevator banks.
The extra set of keys.
Always there is an extra set.
That's original.
I gotta say, if their only way out of the hospital is down that shaft, then how the hell do people go and get the cars when they're going on their rounds?
Well, actually, no. I think they said they've secured the stairwell.
Okay.
I think they said they've cleared out the bottom floor and they've secured the stairwell. So I got the sense that there's a stairwell they can go down, but that it's only accessible to the cops.
And the cops would probably be there or be in the area, so they wouldn't
They certainly seem to be stationed down there, because they've got them on the roof, and at the end of the episode, two or three cops turn up fairly swiftly down on the ground floor, so I imagine that the stairwell is just not an option.
Okay, so they decide that they're going to go through this shaft, the one where we saw very early in the episode where Dr. Edwards dumps the bodies.
Right.
And it was important that they dumped it while it was still warm, because the combination of the noise made by the body falling and the heat indicating life means that the zombies dispose of the bodies for the most part.
Oh, was it heat?
Yeah, they said the body heat would... the noise would attract them, but the body heat would actually make them feast.
Have we heard this before? Because we've known for a long time that the zombies seem to be attracted by at least two things. One is sound and light. But another one is the smell. Anything that moves but doesn't smell rotten is also probably food. But heat?
Because we saw them take down a horse in the very first episode, too, didn't we? Back in Atlanta.
Yeah.
So this is the first time we've heard the idea of body heat being a motivator. Yeah.
Right. But they can detect body heat from nearby?
They may develop small pits beside their nose that can sense the heat, just like a snake does. That might be what's going on.
I've no idea how facetious you're being.
I am being very facetious, actually.
But. Yeah. But they did say body heat, so they do think that the zombies have a way of detecting it.
And I'm assuming that this has been learned through trial and error. If they've dropped bodies when they were cold, I mean, we do see several rotting bodies down there that haven't been eaten very much. So if they've dropped bodies down that weren't eaten, and then they dropped fresh bodies down that were, this would be a pretty clear indicator. So it's been through empirical science that they've discovered this. Okay, so we've got the shaft is
there.
So
we need to get the key.
And Noah says, I can distract Dawn while you go to her office.
We said at the beginning that this wasn't the best episode. Now,
this is a great plan. What are you talking about?
Now, it's not just... I mean, there's a couple of reasons why it wasn't the greatest episode. One is the pace has slowed down considerably from the other episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you're being introduced to a bunch of new characters, many of which are just kind of two-dimensional and are there just to set the plot up.
No sympathy.
Fair enough. But I also thought that the plotting and the action scenes were weaker substantially than they have been in the past. And one example being this idea about the key. Sure, you know, while she's not looking, we'll send you into the office to find the key.
Which could be randomly in any one of these drawers.
This is such a cinematic cliche. How many times have you seen the... and it's another ticking clock device of someone having to sneak into an office to find a key, rummaging around in a desk, only inevitably to be caught in the deep.
I think that the best example of this done for humor was in Zoolander, when the two models go into the room trying to get the files out of the computer. The files are in the computer! And so they start destroying the computer, and they turn into, like, the apes from
2001
A Space Odyssey. Yeah. And, yeah, it's a pretty awesome moment because they're making fun of this, yeah, go into the room and steal this obvious thing. It's all about the MacGuffin, right?
Yeah, when you're using a device that has been satirized in that manner, you need to question its shelf life.
Exactly, but they don't, and that is a problem for sure.
But there is one nice twist to it. I mean,
oh, yeah, the body.
They're putting her in the office to get the key out so she could be caught, so Creepy Gorman can come in, and he has exactly what he wanted. Oh, as if he needed it. It seems like he could have coerced a sexual relationship out of Beth. He has the stick of telling Dawn that Beth has been breaking into her office, which would probably mean her death or expulsion from the hospital.
You think so?
Unless she goes along with his sick desires.
Except that she does find out later. I mean, she figures it out, but she doesn't kill Beth.
Well, Beth has done her a favor, in a way.
Well, by getting rid of Gorman, yeah.
Yeah, you get the sense that Gorman was actually Dawn's biggest threat.
Mm-hmm.
And although Dawn is far from outwardly grateful to Beth, in fact, she gives her another good slap in the face.
With a tool.
Does seem that she owes her a little bit for what happened in that office, and indeed owes another character something.
But before we get to that, let me just say that, you know, as cliched as that particular scene was, there is some interesting setup going on. What's the first thing we see when she comes into the office?
Is it the photograph of her and Hanson?
That would be the second thing we see. The first thing we see is a jar of lollipops sitting on the table. So we see that jar of lollipops, which immediately connects us back to both Noah with the green lollipop and, of course, to Gorman with the forced implied sexual assault on her earlier. So we got that connection.
So this lollipop has been passed through several hands before it's forced into Beth's mouth.
Exactly. It's lovely. And, yeah. Okay, thanks for that image there. That was... Okay, hold on a sec. Yeah. Okay, all right, gone. And then the second thing she sees is the picture of Hanson with handing or shaking hands with Dawn, and his badge is there, and there's obviously she's honoring him on some level. It's kind of like a little mini shrine up on top of her cabinet.
Like in the picture itself, it seems like he's handing her some sort of commendation, like he was a mentor figure that she was forced to turn against.
I can't remember his name, but I did recognize the actor as well. I've seen him in a lot of things. He often plays a cop. We could go back and have a look at that scene, but in any case, there's this little shrine, and then she looks at the desk because she's looking for the key, and she sees something else. On the floor is...
a pool of blood.
Attached to a stumpy arm. So Joan, the girl who earlier was brought into the hospital. We didn't talk about Joan, did we?
We didn't yet, no. We can do her whole character now, though. I think it fits in
with this particular moment, because here we have a young woman played by, oddly enough, Keisha Castle-Hughes, who is an Oscar-nominated young woman who was in The Whale Rider way, way, way back.
She was also the Queen of Naboo in Star Wars Episode
III. Yes, she was. She was the new queen, wasn't she? And she's just been cast as one of the Sand Stakes in the upcoming season of Game of Thrones, so one of Prince Oberyn's bastard daughters. Yes, she's a good actress. Really looking forward to seeing her in that. Here she only...
And her role in this show so far has been to show us that Gorman's a bit of a creep. It seems that she was a victim of this kind of sexual abuse ring
she's
that
tried to
got
get away.
Going in the
she's
background.
Tried to get away.
And as... tried to get away, or it looks like has she allowed herself to be bitten or attempted suicide? I wasn't too clear on that.
To be honest, and I love Greg Nicotero's work. He's amazing with the zombie effects. I couldn't tell, but I'm assuming because of the fact that she was told they were talking about her having left the building. I'm assuming it's a bite. So she's been, and that's why they would cut off her arm too, right? There's
death by zombie, and that would sort of make sense for what happens at the end of this episode. It would explain
there's a resonance.
You know, it looks like they have the capacity to quickly retrieve people who try to escape.
And so she is. Probably bitten. That's why they cut off her arm. She screams at Dawn. She screams, you know, I'm not going back to him. There's no, the him isn't stated, but we do find out later that this is Gorman she's talking about.
We assume it's Gorman, yeah. There is a them. You can't control them.
She says you can't control them, and Dawn says, I will.
But the them is what was key for me, because if it was just him, then the story arc is immediately extinguished with the death of Gorman. But for me, at least, I got the feeling that there is an entity that hasn't been completely defeated in all this.
Well, and then when we see the one cop coming out of a woman's room, slightly before this, I think, the one that has, like, the black square in a slot on her door, and she looks really uncomfortable when Beth sees her, but it's a different cop. It's not Gorman. So it's not just Gorman that's taking sexual advantage of these women. And we see in that hallway, this is the only time we're in that hallway, but Beth sees several other doors with these little black squares on them. So I'm wondering, does that indicate occupied? You know, is that like an occupado kind of sign right there, perhaps?
Yeah, it's kind of gross. Mm-hmm,
absolutely.
So Joan has attempted to commit suicide. Gorman calls her a whore. as she's attempting to resist having her arm cut off. But she's saved. Do we get an idea why she's saved?
Well, she's saved because I think she's got to be made an example of. We can't have people just running away. You know, and so when we saw that hallway, interesting kind of parallel here too, and I know that this is exactly what they were thinking when they created this episode, is, you know, the episode title Slab Town. Slab Town is actually the old red light district of Atlanta. The hospital there in Grady Memorial is a real place in Atlanta, in the old Slab Town. So they've got all these different levels of connection going on. And now you've got this hospital that's been turned back into a brothel, right? So so there's this wonderful kind of synergy going on between the title of the episode, the location of the episode, and what's happening inside the hospital.
That's interesting, because without any of that, I mean, I had no idea why it was called Slab Town. Slab to me suggests mortuary slab.
Well, I think it has a good connection there too, but it was more happenstance than anything. This is an actual place in Atlanta, no longer the red light district, but here we have, you know, post-apocalyptic is turning back into the red light district in a lot of ways, right? Or the Black Square District.
So hospitals are places of prostitution.
Yes.
Almost sounds like a critique of privatized healthcare, Steve.
Oh, no.
It kind of does, you know.
No, but everything has a cost. You have to understand. Everything has a price.
Yeah. Everything has a price. You have a duty not to be weak and to burden the strong.
You owe us.
Anyway, we digress. So Joan tried to kill herself, still not very happy, quite angry and resentful to Gorman. And there she is on the floor in Dawn's office. What's she doing there?
Well, just to quickly, you know, give Keisha her due here, she does have one other spoken line, and that's when Beth is in her room cleaning the floor of the sloppy blood.
Humming away tunelessly.
Yeah, well, but she sings, man. It's art.
Yeah.
It's art, okay? We'd established this. We haven't, but she establishes this earlier when she tells Dr. Edwards that there is still place in humanity for art.
It's not about survival. It's about transcendence.
Oh, how wrong he is.
I know.
This is art. Not us. I mean, this show. Okay, so, yeah. Oh, she's mopping up the blood, and she's whistling tunelessly, and of course, Joan. I almost said Keisha Knight Pullum. She's from Cosby Show, right?
Yeah.
No, so Keisha Castle Hughes says to her, "That's beautiful." And so this kind of reiterates her belief in her own art, that there is still place for beauty in the world. Which, you know, I think is actually an important subtext to this entire episode, that there's still place for that humanity, that side of us. It's not forced on us. It's not pushed. Although, I mean, obviously having the Caravaggio, plus he's playing some really awesome music. So yeah, actually the song that he's got playing when she first goes into his room is by Junior Kimbrough. And the song is titled You Better Run. And it's about a woman who's in an abusive relationship and the advice is to run from it. So this is, you know, clearly a very thinly veiled reference to Beth herself. And this is prior to her actually being attacked by Dawn. So that's all set up pretty early on. This idea of art, and art sometimes obviously imitating life. So she's humming this other song in the room with Joan. And Joan has a bit of a, you know, smile on her face and says it's beautiful, but there's definitely a kind of a sadness in her eyes. And then the next time we see her is as a corpse. She's committed suicide in Dawn's office, and she's etched into the floor, language alert, fuck you.
So I guess what we're supposed to take from this is that Joan has decided to allow herself to turn into a zombie in Dawn's office.
And to take out Dawn.
Yeah, now this is a weird target. You'd think that she'd be more mad at Gorman. She's mad at Dawn for allowing it all to happen, but Gorman seems to be the person that she has the biggest beef with.
Well, this is true, but there's there's a lot of stuff going on here in Canada right now with this Jan Gomeshi thing, for example, which I didn't have any clue I'd ever bring up in this podcast. But there's a lot of people getting angry at a lot of different people. Now, Jan Gomeshi himself, it's going to go possibly through the courts, but it's pretty clear that he's done some pretty horrible things to a lot of women.
Steve and Dan lawyers at this point would like to say allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly. It appears allegedly that he has done some pretty horrible things. Some people have come forward, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of the anger, there's anger at Jan Gomeshi. There's also anger at the women who are coming forward, depending on who you're talking to. But a lot of the anger is also being directed at people that are seen as having been culpable or having hidden his actions.
There's, if anything, a greater degree of resonance in Britain at the moment with the cover-up of the sexual abuse conducted by many people who are working for the BBC and for, you know, different television outlets.
What's
his
face? The guy that passed away recently. What was his name again?
Oh, Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, Jimmy Savile. Wow.
Yeah, seems to have been one of the biggest...
Hundreds of kids.
One of the biggest culprits. But there's several others, like well-known establishment entertainment celebrities who have been found posthumously or otherwise guilty of sexual abuse of children and other sexual offences. But yeah, a lot of the opprobrium, I wouldn't say opprobrium, a lot of the justified anger has been directed at the BBC and the institutions. So Dawn's character, I guess...
Covering up, yeah. Mm-hmm.
She is the legitimate administrative face of this systematic sexual abuse.
So I think that's why she's being targeted here by Joan. And I think that Joan probably feels doubly betrayed because here's Dawn, a woman, who is condoning this unspeakable horror being visited on other women by men.
And not the only one. They make a point of, I don't know how intentional this was, but there's another kind of pretty prim-looking female police officer who's consorted with Dawn at one point.
It's not limited.
Yeah, it seems to me that they're not trying to draw a direct sort of gendered critique here necessarily. It's more about the bureaucracy and the administration versus the vulnerable people.
More of a systemic issue as opposed to a gender issue, yeah.
Absolutely. So Joan has to come up with a clever idea of sneaking into the office and stabbing herself with the scissors so that presumably when she's discovered, she'll be able to take a few people with her.
This is when Gorman decides to come into the office. Basically, Beth sees Joan's body and decides, yeah, actually, I can see what Joan's trying to do here, and that's a great present to leave. So she...
Yeah, Beth's not shocked.
Beth's cool with it. She jimmies open... she looks in one cupboard, in one desk drawer, and then she jimmies the one locked drawer, and of course there's a series of keys, and she picks the right one right away, which isn't labeled, but it does have a purple cover on it, so maybe that's what she was told, although that would have been ex-camera. We didn't see her being told that. So she picks up this key and she's ready to leave when the door opens, and here inevitably comes Gorman.
Yep, so Gorman wanders over to her, pulls the big lech on her, basically says no one need to know,
gets his hand up her shirt,
starts pouring her, and then she grabs
the lollipops.
A jar full of lollipops. some pretty weak poetic justice.
Yeah, well,
in terms of poetry, this is limerick justice.
It's
right
poetic.
Here.
It's poetic justice. Yeah, it's not even haiku justice. Limerick justice might do it. It's a rhyming couplet of justice, but not an iambic pentameter.
This is an iambic blow of lollipop penises to the side of his face.
Yes.
And he goes down. I don't think people do go down when they're hit by jars in the side of their faces.
Well, she hits him in the head. She turns around. He kind of falls back against the desk. It could be just the desk at the back of his legs. I think that's probably why he goes down. Just in time for our good friend Joan to rise from the dead.
Give him the mother of all hickeys.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And that was really well done, actually. Now, again, going back to Nicotero, I wasn't too impressed with Joan's bite, but you did a great job on Officer Gorman's throat. Thank you very much.
That was actually awesome. That was the best scene today. That saved
you could
it.
See his ligaments and his muscles and the blood and yeah, yeah, it was,
and it made sense,
very,
you know,
graphic.
The character was like horrendously one-dimensional, but because he is going to get killed off within the space of one episode, what else can you do? You have to make him completely detestable.
Well, in Love or Hate Emily Kinney as an actress, Beth is this innocent, right? And so we have this guy who's just horrible to this, you know, likable, innocent girl. And so we want to have catharsis, right? We want to have that moment of catharsis, which we're given here.
And we get it. And this is the best bit of action in the whole episode, because I feel that it sort of fades after this point.
Well, we get this, and then we get the basement scene, which has a bit of kind of, again, forced tension because of the darkness, right? If you want tension, put him in a dark basement.
So after Officer Gorman is killed by Joan, so she grabs the service pistol, she wanders off down the corridor, she's worried about the blood on her shoe, she knows that Dawn is a real stickler for that kind of thing, and she sees Dawn, and Dawn's like, what are you up to? And Beth kind of pauses for a minute, and again, it's that pregnant pause that's supposed to suggest, oh, she's thinking about something, isn't it tense? But with those eyes of hers that are as round as saucers, bright blue and utterly vacant.
Bovine.
She could have been thinking about lipstick for all I know. But then she suddenly remembers where she is and she says...
Lollipops, I think.
Lollipops. And she says, oh yeah.
Gorman and Joan want to see you in the office.
Yeah, which is true.
Yes, they sure do. they're hungry.
That seems to be fairly malicious on Beth's behalf. Although it would be good to have a distraction. Do you think that she actually intended to have Dawn killed?
Oh, guaranteed. But she's now at this point committing herself 100% to the escape attempt because as soon as Dawn gets in there and sees what's happened, there, you know, she's coming back for Beth if she survives, right? So her and Noah, they hurry off to the elevator shaft, into the elevator banks, and we hear sounds of gunfire and screaming from the background. So we know that that Dawn has arrived at the office.
Noah has his big towel rope, and he starts lowering them down.
500 towels, at least, I think, in that rope.
At least.
And he has a hard time because as much as he's told Beth about how strong he is, he's not really actually physically that strong, and so he almost drops her extremely negligible weight a couple of times. And then he comes down, and while she's waiting for him, a walker pushes his way through a door on like the second or third floor from the bottom, and he drops
attracted by his body heat,
obviously, and the sound of his shoes banging against the walls, I think. And so he falls the rest of the way and looks like he probably should have broken his leg.
Yeah, making quite a lot of noise as well.
So they go into the basement, and she's got the gun, and there are several walkers coming for them. And this is where we get that false tension of the dark basement, right? Which is just like the sewer level on any first-person shooter you've ever played, where they're trying to falsely ratchet up the tension by creating blindness.
There's a flickering light, some steam escaping from a pipe inexplicably, hands clawing out the darkness.
And then the flash of the gun.
Noah looks pretty pretty scared at this point.
Beth's a hell of a shot, I just want to say, because even though she can't see the zombie, she manages to hit them in the head every bloody time.
Every time, with that gun, which seems to have biggest magazine of any handgun I've ever seen.
It could be one of those extended 15-round clips, but
yeah,
still.
Yeah, maybe. I think I counted about 12 or 13, which I guess isn't that uncommon.
No, well, the police officers will have like those longer, those extended clips as well, right? Yeah. It wasn't a six shooter. It was a like it was a 9mm type gun. I think she was using. If any of our listeners are better at recognizing firearms than we are, you can maybe make a comment or something on the page just to let us know what it was.
Yeah. So they get out of the basement, and then we begin this weird slow motion scene.
Yes.
That seemed designed just to draw out whatever minuscule amount of their special effects budget they decided to sink into this episode.
Mm-hmm.
They just apply the Instagram washed out filter and just let it rip. They bring in some of the extras who weren't quite good enough to make it into the last two episodes when quality of zombies was important.
That's true.
And Beth and Noah just kind of slowly amble their way through these guys.
Slowly at speed.
Popping heads left, right and center. She stamps one completely flat.
But then she runs out of ammo, and yet two more heads explode.
Yeah.
As Noah gets past the throng, she's kind of stuck behind, and he gets to the gate, and as she sees these two heads explode around her...
Two cops take her down, there's another one by the gate.
Yeah,
she's
so they're in the yard, she's going back, and she's cuffed, she's taken... And she gives this little smile to Noah, whom she barely knows.
I was almost ready for Beth to buy it at this point.
Well, the whole slow-mo kind of made me think there's going to be a death here. Like, the idea of the slow motion, and there was no sound except for music playing, right? We had, like, music playing in the background. That very much seemed to me like this sudden ramping up of the dramatic tension so that we could appreciate the death more.
And Beth is pulling, like, a reverse St. Peter. She's doing the opposite of Edwards. She's sacrificing herself to let someone else get away. So it gives the whole episode a little bit of thematic balance.
Are you saying she's... Jesus?
I was ready, and I gotta admit, eager to see Beth just buy it at the end of this episode. But she doesn't buy it. We have a denouement when she is brought back inside and has to face Dawn for one last time.
So you got Gorman, you got Joan, you got a third cop dead. Or a second cop dead, I should say. So three bodies in the office, and she's not happy. And they have a really good conversation here, actually. And here you got a situation where Beth shows exactly how tough she is. She calls her out. She's talking to Dawn, and Dawn's justifying all of her actions, saying, basically, I've done what I've had to do. We're going to get rescued. You know, we ought to keep alive until those people come to save us. And Beth looks at her, and she's just completely flabbergasted that Dawn's going down this line. She goes, okay, so in this denouement, Beth calls Dawn out. She's no longer the naive, scared Beth that Dawn assumes she is. She's now the I've been trained by Daryl Beth, and I'm going to tell you what it's really like. And Dawn says, you know, we got to wait here. We got to keep things going. We got to, you know, I have to make compromises to keep people alive because there's going to be a rescue. And Beth just looks at her incredulously, and she says, no one's coming, Dawn. No one's coming. We're all going to die, and you let this happen for nothing. And she's disgusted by her at this point. She's like, are you serious? And Dawn, she reacts with her best eye acting of the episode as her eyes get larger and larger. And she looks totally shocked because she realizes it. At this point, her eyes actually stray, and they look down to see the picture, right, of her and Hansen. And what's happened to that picture?
It's broken, Steve.
It's broken, Dawn. Dawn?
Yeah.
Dan.
Talking to the Steve and Dawn podcast. The Joan and Dawn podcast.
Woo! Okay, well, the Beth and Dawn. So we've got a broken... Is that a symbol, do you think? Do you think that might be symbolic of something, perhaps?
It's groundbreaking stuff.
It is. I've never even thought of showing...
It's a rosebud moment.
And it's got glass. It's broken glass. Broken frame. The frame which encompassed their lives is broken.
Yeah.
The glass which protected them from the outside and the cold and the evil is broken.
Revealing the surface of the image, Steve.
Indeed, the surface. It's within reach.
Belying its depth.
But the truth, man, the truth frickin' hurts.
The truth
okay?
lies on the floor, Steve.
The truth does, with the blood of Joan.
And the shame of whoever wrote that scene.
She wears her shame like a well pressed officer uniform, actually. She wears it well.
So pretty junior stuff there. But whatever. Everyone's allowed to bet that.
And so, you know, rather than going, hey, Beth, you got a good point there, she picks up what looks to be, I don't know, like a piece of leather and smacks her hard across the face.
Oh, I thought it was the actual picture itself.
Do you think it was the picture? It could have been the picture.
Yeah, I thought she just smacked her in the head with the picture.
There was that leather bit there beside. I thought it was black what she had in her hand, but it could very well have been the picture. So,
that she was just so enraged by the metaphor.
So she hits her with the mat. The mat that's in behind the picture, which is obviously extremely hard.
Oh,
she's got a lead mat. She smacks her across the face, and we cut to black, and we come back, and there's Beth in Dr. Edwards' office. He's playing new music now, but of course the Caravaggio is still there, and she confronts him now. She's not done with her confrontation. She's like, yeah, I'm going to confront Don. Now I'm going to confront you. He says that you're healing well, which is another thing that kind of messed up my timeline here, because I'm thinking, well, how long has it been since this interaction between the two of them?
And what healing is he talking about, from just getting smacked by Dawn or from the things that happened to her when she first came in?
Exactly. And then he tells her the story of the painting about it being the denial of St. Peter. And so we get into that whole kind of imagery, the biblical imagery comes back in, and that he's trying to make excuses for himself because, you know, even St. Peter wasn't perfect, therefore why should he be?
Yeah, so one thing that's happened a lot in this season is consistent Judeo-Christian religious imagery,
and
not only just in the church in the last episode, but also in the names of many of the characters. We talked briefly about the significance of Gabriel, but we also have Abraham, who's leading people off wherever he's leading them, and now we have Noah and references to St. Peter. Is there a particular reason, do you think, that all of this imagery is being used in such a condensed manner, or is it simply an accident of the names of the characters as they were given in the comics?
Well, to be fair, yeah, the names do come from the comics to a large degree, and if you think we've had some doozies so far, biblically speaking, we've got some more potentially to come down the road. I'm not going to give any spoilers here, but I really do think that Kirkman and his choice of names, and Noah here, by the way, is not a character that I'm familiar with from the comic books. It may be that he is a composite of other characters. I haven't had any chance yet to get to know him well enough.
So the name Noah isn't even in the comics?
No, it's not in the comics as far as I recall. Now, we do have the scriptwriters or Scott Gimple, the showrunner, playing into the same tropes that Kirkman has been working with in the comics on some level. I think the reason they're doing this, to be fair, is the whole end of days idea, the connection between like the dead rising in the Book of Revelations and the trope of the zombie that we've had since Romero's, you know, classics back in the 60s.
The Lazarus figure in
the Book of Revelations, the idea that all the dead will rise. This is why in some Christian sects you do not, like especially in Roman Catholicism, you don't burn the bodies. You bury your dead because they're going to come back. They're going to need their bodies. There's this conception of the dead actually re-inhabiting their own bodies and coming back and walking the earth, which builds beautifully into the whole zombie trope, of course.
Right. So I mean, we understand that Judeo-Christian imagery is something that's always available to Western audiences to help tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's a narrative resource we can dip into to get certain points across. But there's been a particularly sort of concentrated bit of biblical imagery. So it just makes me wonder if we're following specific biblical storylines in this season. It'd be interesting to see how it plays out.
Where does Noah fit in? I mean, is he going to bring a whole bunch of animals with him or something? Or, you know, I have no idea. Outside of his kind of Judas connection, you also found some connections with Gabriel and the Bible and the idea of being, I believe, a messenger is what you'd found?
Yeah, Gabriel is the figure of the messenger. I'm not sure exactly what message he has to give the group so far.
His only message was, this is a house of God, and of course Maggie quickly shut that down. No, it's just four walls and a roof.
The one obvious thing with Noah, of course, is that we're in Atlanta, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta is an urban center, so it's kind of a symbol of the heights of civilization, yet it's a civilization very much in decline. And what we're seeing within the last vestiges of humanity here in the hospital is some of the worst biblical sins. There's fornication, there's murder.
Gluttony, lust. Yeah,
right.
Well, that's fornication, isn't it?
And yet, and at the same time, as we're seeing all of these scenes of, you know, sexual abuse and people getting slapped around and imprisoned, we have the ticking clock and we have Noah making ready his escape, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it seems, do you think that the ticking clock is suggesting that there is another disaster about to befall Atlanta, or at least this hospital, and that Noah is leading a kind of exodus out of a terminal situation.
So he's been told the flood is coming and he's preparing. Yeah.
Okay, it seems like something bad is coming to
the
hospital.
I think we might be stretching here, but I think that, well, the something bad that's coming to the hospital is what's inside of it, eating it from the inside out, right? That's the rot.
Yeah.
That's the bad thing that's coming. It's not like there's a biblical plague coming upon them or a flood or what have you. I think it's just that they're basically on their last legs.
It's true, but I can see, I mean, the city's already been hit by napalm, which is a kind of fiery version of a flood, and we can also see on a lot smaller scale the likes of Rick and Daryl are going to, you know, presumably turn up and attack this hospital at some point.
Yeah, they're not going to leave Beth and now her new patient in the hospital. We do have this the final scene of the episode we need to talk about briefly, in that she's not only confronted Dawn, she's also confronted Edwards, and mm-hmm. she's obviously made a choice. She takes a pair of scissors from Edwards' desk, mm-hmm. and she's walking towards him.
Do you think it's Edward who's the target there, or do you think it's Dawn?
Dawn's not in the hallway yet. It's Edward she's got her eyes on.
So why is she so mad at him?
Because she feels betrayed, because he forced her to kill somebody against mm-hmm. her will, and so she's feeling betrayed. And
you think that's all it takes? Because I mean, many of the characters in Beth's life have made judgment calls of that kind,
but not with this kind of malice. They generally do it for better reasons. You mm-hmm. do have a lot of people killing people, but usually for more pragmatic reasons rather than personal and nasty reasons, or personally, not usually for such self-serving purposes as mm-hmm. what Edwards has done here.
Now, Beth does have an issue with Edwards, but there's another reason why she might target Edwards. That if she takes Edwards down, the whole hospital falls, because as we know, he's the only functioning doctor.
Yeah, and she's definitely not going to give up trying to get out. Now that she's made one escape attempt, she's going to keep going until she's either out or dead. That's it. So she's already made her bed. She's going to go and continue. She takes out Edwards. She causes more chaos. You know she's not going to stab his head. She's probably going to cut his throat. So he turns because, uh-huh. you know, again, walkers can be tools in certain situations. Look at how Rick left that guy in the bathroom. He choked him to death. He didn't put him out of his misery. That uh-huh. was in Claimed last season. I think it was episode 409 or 410.
Yeah,
and in
501 with the survivors from Terminus, they were yeah. all left to turn.
Yeah, absolutely. They do this sometimes as a punishment and sometimes as a tool.
So she's wandering down the corridor with the scissors in her hand, and then what does she see?
There's Dawn and a couple of other officers wheeling in what, to be honest, at first I thought was Daryl from the haircut. And then as it gets closer, we realize, in fact, it isn't Daryl, but it is...
It's Carol.
It is Carol, or Curl, as you like to say. And she's unconscious, mm-hmm. being wheeled into a room. She hides the knife or the pair of scissors up her sleeve, and she goes in to help. It changes the game.
And we fade to black.
This tells us a lot about what's going on in the background. We know that in episode two, Daryl and Carol took off after the car with the White Cross. So they have arrived at the hospital. They're abduction vehicles, more than anything. Mm-hmm. So we know that they've arrived at the hospital, and but Carol's come in. We know Daryl gets back to the church. So they've separated, obviously. Daryl doesn't look too happy at the church back at the end of episode 3, and he's got somebody...
So we can only surmise that Carol is not the person he's brought back with him.
Because she's in the hospital. So, my new theory that we talked about a little bit earlier, you and I, privately, mm-hmm. is that he's got Noah with him.
Right.
And
That seems to be the biggest contender right now.
Well, and then that leads to another surmisal that Carol is in the hospital of her own cognizance. She's chosen to go in there because she wants to work from the inside. Daryl's going to go get the rest of the group to work from the outside, and they're going to get Beth out.
So she's a Trojan.
She is a Trojan. She is the Trojan rabbit.
So, there are two possibilities. One is that she was genuinely injured or taken down while she was hanging around outside the hospital and happened to be rescued. But I like your theory. It does make a lot of sense, particularly in the context of what was said before about Noah's family. When Noah went in with his dad, what happened?
Well, you've got the stronger father being allowed to die. So if you look at Carol and Daryl on the surface, without knowing how much of a badass she is, who are you going to think is the stronger?
Oh, for sure. Daryl, you're going to take him out in a second.
Exactly. So Carol is seen as potentially another, you know, sexual object, potentially yeah. another worker in the hospital, somebody who's not going to be a threat. So she knows this. She knows that that's how she'll be perceived. But she also knows how extremely badass she is. So,
yeah.
And this would be the sort of thing that Carol would do for the group. She's already shown a willingness to sacrifice everything because she loves them, even to the point of removing herself from the group. So I do not see this at all as being a stretch. I think this is totally in character for Carol. I think that she is going into that hospital fully intent on trying to get Beth out. I can see that they may have set up a situation where they made some noise, maybe set off a firecracker or two. They may have had something left from what they took with that guy back outside Terminus from Marvin or Martin, I think his name was. It would be something that to get the attention of the people in the hospital, and then she's maybe knocked out. I could see Daryl hitting her on the back of the head reluctantly, but doing so just to give it the perception of her being in trouble and needing help, you know, with him watching just in case they didn't come. And then she's taken in. And
in order to rescue today's episode, we need to see, even if it's not next episode, but a couple down the line, a sort of commando style, her breaking her way out of that compound.
So we're not going to be seeing it for at least 2 weeks, because next week from the previews, we're going to be having Abraham, Glenn, Maggie, and co. on their trip up towards DC.
Yeah, they're off to DC.
They're off to see the
politicians.
That's because I'm sure the politicians can get lots done. Well, it all depends on who wins the midterm elections next week in the States, I suppose.
That's a good point. If the Republicans take the Senate, then Abraham knows that there's just no point going.
Well, no, but the Republicans are tough on crime and they're tough on disease. Well, no.
They're tough on crime, but they're not into public spending.
Oh.
So do you really think they're going to rebuild Atlanta?
Oh, that's a good point. Okay.
You saw what happened to New Orleans, man.
So Georgians, you know who to vote for. Well, Dan, this was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it was not the best episode.
No, not the best episode, but still still pretty important, I think. It takes us back into an urban environment, and we were talking about how it'd be nice to see some different scenery. It actually felt kind of weird being in a hospital, to be honest.
Yes.
It's going to be interesting watching Carol and Laura friends burn it down in a couple of weeks' time.
Absolutely. Well, here's looking forward to that, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, mate. I'll speak to you soon.
Cheers. Random sounds at the end of the podcast, just for your entertainment.